Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Rising prices. New data shows inflation remains stubbornly high, squeezing American consumers and casting a shadow over the larger U.S. economy. Then, taking stock, Ukrainians return to their homes in areas liberated from the invading Russian military to sift through the remains of the lives they were forced to leave behind. And rethinking college. Applications to black colleges and universities rise dramatically, even as nationwide student enrollment falls.
Young people are choosing to be in a place that nurtures them, that recognizes who they are in the world, and really thinks about how they can make this generation of young black people succeed.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The August inflation report is out, and the upshot is gas prices have dropped, but the bottom line is still worse than expected. The U.S. Labor Department says overall consumer prices rose 8.3% from a year ago, slightly smaller than July's increase. But the rate of increase for core items, not counting food and fuel, surged more than 6% from a year earlier. That was sharply higher than July's figure. The report triggered Wall Street's worst day since June of 2020, amid fears of more interest rate hikes. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 1,276 points to close below 31,105, down 4%. The NASDAQ fell 5%. The S&P 500 was down 4.3%. To help us understand more about this day's news, I'm joined by economist Julia Coronado. She's the founder of her own firm, Macro Policy Perspectives, and a former economist for the Fed. Julia Coronado, welcome back to the NewsHour. So we do see gas prices coming down. There are other hints that demand may be slowing. Why is inflation persisting?
Yeah, we had hoped for better from this report. And as you said, we did see the relief on gas prices, but a broad range of other goods and services that consumers spend their money on, those prices kept rising. And that came despite improving supply chain functioning, signs of shipping costs and other commodity prices declining. All of that had led us to hope and expect more of that relief passed on to the consumer. But we just didn't see that. We haven't seen that. Areas like new cars and furniture prices continue to rise despite, as you noted, moderating consumer demand, improved production and supply chain operations. So far, that relief that we are seeing in the wholesale level is not being passed along to consumers.
So I'm hearing you said that twice now, not passed on to consumers. Why isn't it being passed on by these companies to consumers?
Well, we're going to be in a tug of war in the next few months. We companies, especially companies that sell goods that consumers bought in scale during the pandemic and were relatively price insensitive because they were in lockdown, those companies enjoyed really healthy, strong profit margins through the pandemic, and they're trying to hold on to those profit margins and not accept narrower margins. And so it's really going to be up to competitive pressures in markets like cars and furniture for consumers to, you know, express their sentiments with their wallets and for some bargaining and some relief. And so it's going to be a process that will play out probably over a number of months.
So do I understand you to say that a lot of this, much of this, is at the discretion of these big companies that determine prices?
Yeah, I mean, this is an inflection point in the economy. We are seeing consumers, we're seeing demand slow. Consumer spending has slowed down quite a bit from the soaring numbers of last year. Things like car sales have been quite weak this year, despite improving production numbers. So there is a sort of decision that, say, for example, car dealers need to make, that do you want to keep selling fewer cars at higher prices, or do you want to sell more cars at more competitive prices? And so far, that dam hasn't broken in the consumer's favor. But, you know, at some point there will be enough inventories on hand. It's also interesting, Judy, because we've been hearing through company reports, through some of the major retailers, they have been talking about rising inventory levels and the need to discount. It's just not showing up in the data in any decisive or broad-based way yet, though.
So we have been expecting the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates when they meet next week, another 0.75%. How is all this news likely to affect their thinking?
Well, it certainly solidifies the jumbo 75 basis point, 0.75 percentage point rate hike next week. That's a done deal. And what it does is it raises the likelihood that more jumbo rate hikes lie ahead. So the market reacted so strongly because we had had a string of data that pointed to more sort of a soft landing scenario. The July inflation report had been quite hopeful.
Right.
The labor market data has been quite resilient. And so that data spoke to maybe the U.S. economy will make it through this rate hiking cycle without going into a recession. This report is a vote in on the hard landing side. It suggests that the Fed is going to have to keep raising rates until we really see broader based relief on the inflation front. It can't just be gas prices.
And just in a quick nutshell, the health of the overall U.S. economy?
So we're still growing. I mean, certainly the labor market has been quite strong. The unemployment rate remains well below 4%. That's a very low unemployment rate. And consumers are feeling a bit better from that relief on gas prices. So overall, we're still kind of muddling along, growing, not tipping into a recession yet. But again, I think the risk of that kind of a scenario for next year, the market, that's what the market is seeing. The risk of that scenario is rising if inflation doesn't cool off.
Julia Coronado, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
In the day's other news, Ukraine said that its forces have now pushed within 2 miles of the Russian border in the northeastern Kharkiv region. But in Moscow, the Kremlin played down criticism and brushed aside calls for an all-out military mobilization. We'll return to Ukraine after the news summary. Britain's King Charles III traveled to Northern Ireland today as he tours the United Kingdom since assuming the throne. The King and Queen consort were cheered in Belfast, and later Charles spoke of the late Queen Elizabeth's hopes for healing the region's Protestant Catholic divisions.
My mother felt deeply, I know, the significance of the role she herself played in bringing together those whom history had separated, and in extending a hand to make possible the healing of long-held hurts.
Meanwhile, in Edinburgh, Scotland, thousands of mourners viewed the Queen's coffin overnight and today, paying their respects. Elizabeth will lie in state in London starting tomorrow. Back in this country, Ken Starr, whose independent counsel investigation led to President Clinton's impeachment, has died in Houston after complications from surgery. He had been Solicitor General before being named to look into Clinton real estate dealings. The probe ultimately included the sex scandal involving former intern Monica Lewinsky. 2 years ago, Starr served on then-President Trump's impeachment defense team. Ken Starr was 76 years old. A major teachers' strike is ending. Seattle Public Schools reached an agreement late Monday with the teachers' union. The walkout began September 7th with teachers demanding better pay and classroom support. Alleged security flaws at Twitter were back in the spotlight today. A former chief security officer at the company, Peter Mudge Zatko, testified at a U.S. Senate hearing after being fired earlier this year. He filed an 84-page whistleblower complaint 2 months ago. Today, he charged that Twitter is a decade behind industry security standards.
The company's cybersecurity failures make it vulnerable to exploitation, causing real harm to real people. And when an influential media platform can be compromised by teenagers, thieves, and spies, and the company repeatedly creates security problems on their own, this is a big deal for all of us.
Billionaire Elon Musk has tried to cancel his takeover of Twitter, citing its security flaws. In return, the company is suing to make him honor the $44 billion deal. Cleanup is underway in Southern California after tropical storm remnants triggered mudslides. Massive amounts of mud cascaded into homes, buildings, and vehicles on Monday. Thousands of people were told to evacuate or shelter in place. It happened in mountainous areas where wildfires had burned away vegetation. The National Basketball Association has suspended Phoenix Suns and Phoenix Mercury owner Robert Sarver for a year for workplace misconduct. It also fined him $10 million, the maximum under league rules. This follows allegations that Sarver had a history of using racist and misogynistic language and abusing employees. This year's primetime Emmy bragging rights go to Apple TV's Ted Lasso and HBO's Succession. They led the way at last night's ceremony. Notable first-time awardees included Lee Jung-jae of Squid Game on Netflix and Cheryl Lee Ralph won for her role in ABC's Abbott Elementary. We'll hear from Cheryl Lee Ralph later in the program. And legendary French filmmaker Jean-Luc Godard died today at his home in Switzerland. France's President Emmanuel Macron called him a national treasure. Jeffrey Brown has this remembrance.
New York Herald Tribune!
The unconventional camera work and storytelling, the jump cuts, and much more. The 1960 movie Breathless helped usher in a bold, new, and influential style of filmmaking, and made director Jean-Luc Godard one of cinema's great innovators. Beginning in the late 1950s and into the 60s, he and other young filmmakers, including François Truffaut, became known as the French New Wave. Godard made a string of movies that often drew from his past heroes, such as Alfred Hitchcock, but created a new aesthetic that influenced generations of directors to come. Martin Scorsese called the 1963 movie Contempt, starring Brigitte Bardot, one of his favorite films of all time, and referred to Godard as among the great modern visual artists of cinema. Quentin Tarantino compared him to Bob Dylan, saying, quote, they both revolutionized their forms. Godard would combine mainstream, experimental, and left-wing political filmmaking for decades. But today, the focus was on his breakthrough work and influence. He died at his home in Switzerland. A family statement gave assisted suicide as a cause of death, saying the filmmaker suffered from, quote, multiple pathologies.
Jean-Luc Godard was 91 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, why child poverty significantly declined during the pandemic. Author Nina Totenberg remembers her decades-long friendship with the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Cheryl Lee Ralph delivers a rousing speech after winning an Emmy for her role in a comedy series about public education, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Ukraine says that hundreds of thousands of people have been freed from Russian control in recent days in an offensive that has reshaped the battlefield. The counterattack began at the end of August. Ukraine publicly emphasized the southern region of Kherson. But troops have made more gains in the Kharkiv region, where officials say there are still pockets of fighting. In the past week, Ukraine has retaken more territory than Russia took in the past 5 months, and they've recaptured dozens of towns. Nick Schifrin traveled to an area recently seized back. He found people returning to their homes and others mourning for all that was lost.
The road north of Kharkiv is littered with the remains of a Russian withdrawal. This used to be the front lines, but in the last few days, the Russian military pulled back and the Ukrainian military advanced. It's now once again Ukrainian held, recaptured at great cost.
All up and down this road, you can see signs of the battle. That was a market. These two places, believe it or not, sold travel insurance to visit Russia, and across the street, a restaurant, a cafe, and a money exchange. And now that Ukrainians have gained access to this territory, they're going to see what the Russians left behind.
We drove toward the Russian border with prosecutors and crime scene investigators looking into Russian war crimes. Along the route, mostly empty roads and mostly empty villages. One of them, Ruska Lozova. It had a pre-war population of more than 5,000. Today, it's in the dozens.
So this is the first time you've been home since the invasion.
37-year-old Vladimir Soloha invited me into his home he hadn't seen in 6 months. There's some damage, but he's lucky. The house is intact. It has no electricity or water, but it's exactly the way they left it when they fled. His 18-month-old daughter's crib, his 6-year-old daughter's toys, drawings of a more peaceful time, as they were the moment the invasion began.
I woke up at 4:30 and the shooting began, very loud. I ran back into the house, grabbed our kids, got the stuff that we could grab fast. We got into our car and left, and that's it.
And why did you come back today?
Our army, the armed forces of Ukraine, pushed the Russians all the way to the border, so it's more or less safe here. So I decided to come here to feed my dog and feed my cats. I found my dog, but we also had 3 cats, and I still don't know what happened to them.
He checked the outside shed, the backyard, even the side room of the garage. Finally, cat located on the roof. After 6 months of scrounging for food, it finally gets fed. But its owner's hunger for peace remains unsatisfied.
My wife and kids won't return here until Russia stops shelling Kharkiv completely, because that's still what is happening every day. There are still strikes every day, and it's not safe to come back.
We head further north to within 8 miles of the Russian border. Ukraine's recent success allows Kharkiv police to reach areas that until this past weekend were too dangerous. But in the past, Russia's left behind booby traps, so the bomb squad checks a discarded car and the area around it for tripwires or unexploded bombs. A few feet away, an unexploded mortar round, a reminder of the fighting that only recently ended. Once it's all clear, the crime scene investigators go to work. In early March, a Ukrainian family was driving this car north when they were attacked by a Russian machine gun. The car then caught fire. They comb through the debris looking for human remains. All that's left, small bone chips. And rescued from the mud, a reminder of the lives lost, a watch. Oleksandr Klochko is the CSI team leader.
How important is this kind of work when it comes to documenting Russian crimes here?
It's very important because all of these documents will be further submitted to the Office of the Prosecutor General of Ukraine, who in turn will send them to The Hague for further prosecution to bring the perpetrators to justice.
Klochko's office is in Kharkiv City. It was destroyed by a Russian rocket yesterday.
When we hear the stories of what happened here, and when we get on the site and see the tragedy inflicted on these people, of course it's psychologically difficult, but we're holding out.
And then here is 65-year-old Anatoly Hrapach. He is not a soldier nor a police officer. The man and girl who were killed in this car were his son and granddaughter. Anatoly on the right, his son Andriy on the left. Anatoly with 9-year-old Ksenia.
She was a schoolgirl, 9 years old. She used to dance and do figure skating.
Businessman.
He was an entrepreneur. He traveled a lot. And everything is gone now.
When you look at this scene, how do you feel? What are you thinking?
Ужас.
Horror.
Ужас, я так.
Horror. What can you say? It's been half a year already, but still. I don't have the strength.
The whole family was in the car, Andriy and Ksenia on the right. But remarkably, Olena and 17-year-old Misha on the left survived and made it to Germany. We spoke to Misha today online.
Russia now is a terrorist state, and I think that the whole world should know what this country do with me, with my family, and with my country, with Ukraine. Because we were just civilians and they were soldiers. For what my father and my sister died, for what they were just a civilian.
Will getting these remains, will working with this team from the police help you find some kind of closure, some kind of solace?
I think yes. But this is difficult.
Difficult, perhaps impossible, to ever understand what Russia has left behind. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
The child poverty rate in the U.S. fell by nearly half last year to 5.2%. That is the lowest level on record and is based on a Census Bureau measure that takes into account cash benefits, tax credits, and other kinds of non-cash benefits, many of which increased during the pandemic. Meantime, nearly 92% of Americans had health insurance for some part of the year. But overall, inequality increased, and median income remained largely flat. That drop in childhood poverty was preceded by an even larger decline since the 90s. All this is according to a new analysis done by the nonpartisan research group Child Trends and the New York Times. Dana Thompson is one of the lead researchers, and she joins me now. So hello, Dana Thompson. Dropping by nearly half child poverty, how did it happen?
That's a great question. Yes, what we're looking at here is really a remarkable success story. In 1993, about one in four kids in the U.S. were experiencing poverty. And by 2019, we had reduced that by nearly 60% to one in 10. And that's largely thanks to the growth in the social safety net and a healthy economy.
So social safety net, that means government programs. What portion of this drop would you say is due to government aid?
So we didn't estimate the exact portion due to government aid, but we did include, as you said, a collection of programs. And we looked at programs such as the Earned Income Tax Credit, Social Security, Nutrition and Housing Assistance, and Unemployment Insurance. And together, they reduced child poverty by about 44% in 2019 alone.
And you said, but some of this also due to improvements in the economy?
That's exactly right. So in 2019, we had lower unemployment rates, more single moms entering the workforce, and increases in state minimum wages. And each of those were associated with the decline in child poverty.
And where, Dana Thompson, do you see most of this improvement? I mean, is it spread evenly among all children, or are there differences geographically, racially, or by some other measure?
Yeah, so amazingly, we saw child poverty decline across all 50 states and D.C. and across all levels of poverty. We also saw child poverty decline for nearly all subgroups of children that we examined. That includes children in immigrant families as well as children in non-immigrant families. We saw declines across all race ethnicities, and we just saw declines across different family types. However, because poverty declined at similar rates for each of these groups, the disparities between these groups persisted. So children in single-parent families and Black and Hispanic children were about three times as likely to experience poverty in 1993, and they're still three times as likely to experience poverty as their peers.
So you're not seeing an improvement when it comes to comparing some of these specific groups. Is that right?
That's correct.
Let me ask you about the view of some conservatives out there who say when you give this kind of government aid, it should be accompanied by a work requirement. How much was there a work requirement in the programs that you described, and can you tell whether that had an effect one way or another?
Yeah, so the amazing thing about this decline is that we've also seen it as fairly robust across multiple administrations, and the social safety net is comprised of a mix of programs. Some of those programs have work requirements. Some of them are have no work requirements. So the earned income tax credit, for instance, is conditional on work, and it's been one of our most effective longstanding programs for reducing child poverty. And it's particularly important because it helps make work work for families, because it boosts their wages, especially when wages are too low to support a family. But there are also a host of other programs, many of which are not conditional on work. And these include the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program and unemployment insurance. And those programs naturally expand during recessions and are really critical for families when they're facing temporary setbacks.
So remind us, to what extent are these programs you've been talking about in danger of being cut back or eliminated altogether? I mean, what are we looking at in terms of their durability, the fact that they would continue for years to come? What do you see there?
I do think that we have kind of a robust mix of programs right now. And again, as I said, you know, this mix of programs has been with us through multiple administrations. So I think there's solid backing for a lot of those programs. Of course, we've seen during recessions the implementation of a number of temporary measures that have helped families really make ends meet during, you know, times of increased economic hardship. So those include some of the measures that were implemented during the pandemic, such as stimulus payments, the advanced child tax credit, pandemic EBT, and rental assistance. And those have been really critical for preventing an increase in child poverty, and are an important moving forward as well.
I should say finally that there are still, by what you're reporting, over 8 million American children who are still living below the poverty line. In a nutshell, what's the difference in the quality of life for them versus these other children who've benefited?
It's really important to remember that there are real people behind these numbers. And as you know, I'm sure there's a wealth of evidence that shows that growing up in poverty impacts virtually every dimension of child development, from physical and mental health, as well as behavioral health, to educational attainment and labor market success as adults. So reducing child poverty not only improves well-being for children and families, but it also has long-term net benefits for society.
Dana Thompson with Child Trends, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
The total number of undergraduate college students in the U.S. has dropped by almost 10% during the pandemic. But it's been a different story for some time at many historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, where interest and funding have increased. Applications were up nearly 30% at many of these schools between 2018 and 2021. And top-tier HBCUs are increasingly becoming the first choice for some of the country's most sought-after students. Yet, HBCUs face some fundamental challenges, too. Special correspondent Hari Srinivasan has this report. It's the first in our latest series on rethinking college.
I turned down Harvard and UC Berkeley.
Harvard, Penn, Yale, Duke, USC, Emory, right down the street, Vanderbilt.
These are all the places sophomores Cadence Patrick and Sakai Parker turned down to come to Spelman College, an all-women's HBCU, or historically black college and university in Atlanta.
There's no, you have to pass this test to prove that you're good enough, to prove that you're smart enough, because I mean, we've already shown our excellence.
In high school, I noticed like if I had a good like academic standing or a success, it was more so like, wow, I didn't know you could do that, rather than this is what's expected of you here.
For Parker, on a pre-med track with a health science major, it was her experience at her majority white high school that led her here.
I feel like I had the responsibility to represent for the black community, but also speak for other people about their experiences that I have no idea about. It was very exhausting having to represent all the time.
Patrick, who's studying computer science, said her parents were split on her decision. Her dad favored Harvard, her mom, Spelman. For her, it came down to a sense of belonging.
The percent of Black students at Ivies is very, very small. And so that can be a daunting statistic to be walking into. There's so few people that look like me who share my experience. I'm gonna have to prove myself at every step of the way.
HBCUs like Spelman College have seen a surge in interest. In 2014, more than 4,000 people applied. In 2021, that nearly tripled with more than 11,000 applicants.
Certificate program for adult learners.
Dr. Helene Gale took over as the institution's president this summer. An epidemiologist and a leader in public health, she spent her career in government and nonprofit roles. She views what's happening in the admissions office as a reflection of the rapid social change in the country.
This is a generation that grew up with a Black president. They've gone through some of the social unrest following the murder of George Floyd and kind of the movement around Black lives. Young people are choosing to be in a place that nurtures them, that recognizes who they are in the world, and really thinks about how they can make this generation of young Black people succeed.
The increasingly competitive student pool comes as no surprise to Rosalind Gates Brewer, a proud Spelman alumna and the chair of the college's Board of Trustees.
Our talent pools have been very similar to the Yale and Harvard candidates, but Spelman is an absolute deliberate choice.
Before becoming the CEO of the Walgreens Boots Alliance last year, that operates some 9,000 drugstores across the U.S., she's also held top positions at Starbucks and Sam's Club.
About 10% of our class is graduating Phi Beta Kappa. Now, you wouldn't see 45 to 50 Black women graduate Phi Beta Kappa from Harvard or Yale, right? But you get that at Spelman College.
Brewer, a first-generation college graduate, is one of only two Black females running Fortune 500 companies.
There is something that I will tell you that is deep in my gut around taking on big challenges. And I'm not afraid of those, and I think I gained that at Spelman College.
While HBCUs account for just 3% of post-secondary institutions, they educate about 9% of all Black college students and produce about 13% of all African-American undergraduate degrees.
Historically, Black colleges were founded with clearly a racial justice initiative to attend to the ways in which African-Americans could not attend white colleges and universities.
Professor Beverly Guy Shiftall has been teaching at Spelman, her alma mater, for more than 50 years.
Many of them, for the first time, they have Black professors. They also see a Black college president, and they hear over and over again that this is a place made for you.
More than 60% of HBCU students are Pell Grant eligible, and tuitions average about 30% lower than predominantly white institutions. HBCUs also enroll more first-generation and academically underprepared students than other four-year schools.
We punch so well above our weight. When we think about what we're able to turn out with less resources than many of our peer majority institutions.
But there are still challenges. With less financial help from state and federal governments historically and far smaller endowments than other schools.
There's been a bias from the very beginning, and you can look at state institutions that are predominantly Black and state institutions that are white, and there's always been a huge gap. We don't have adequate housing. We don't always have adequate infrastructure, latest technology.
Federal lawmakers have increased funding for HBCUs, providing nearly $2 billion since 2017, as well as an additional $2.7 billion this year in pandemic emergency relief. Alumni and philanthropists have donated more than $1 billion in recent years, funding scholarships and programs in science, technology, and other fields. But it's still not enough.
There have been lawsuits in states that found that their system underfunded their Black public colleges.
Nandria Njoku heads the United Negro College Fund's Frederick D. Patterson Research Institute here in Atlanta. She co-authored a recent report calling for more funding.
We did a survey of our member institutions, and we found a majority of them have at least $5 million in deferred maintenance. We still need those unrestricted funds to take care of the facilities and upgrade our institutions in the ways that we can continue to retain the students who have increased interest in enrollment.
Better-known HBCUs like Spelman College are not in danger, but other institutions, many of them smaller and in rural areas, have not experienced the same recent surge in interest.
About a third of the HBCUs, 30 to 35 of them, were in the red zone, financially precarious. They were tuition-driven, and for an institution to be tuition-driven, it's like an individual living paycheck to paycheck.
John Wilson served as the president of Morehouse College and as a White House advisor on historically black colleges. He's writing a book about HBCUs and says the schools should seize the moment.
We've seen it come and go in cycles. If you go back to the 1980s when Ronald Reagan took office, there was a national climate that was more racially hostile. The ideal is for HBCUs to be in charge of their own magnetism, to not be subject to the whims of the marketplace, but to control your own destiny.
HBCUs also play a broader role in society, with a history of propelling black students into the middle class.
Their social mobility status is transformed. They can go from the bottom quintile to middle class because of the tools and skills that they get at these HBCUs. Spelman is an incubator of black women who go on to STEM careers.
Guy Shiftall doesn't see the interest in HBCUs declining.
To the extent that the U.S. remains hostile to people who are different, you need special mission institutions. You need ones that are Hispanic serving, you need women's colleges, you need tribal colleges desperately, and you need HBCUs.
Despite all the challenges facing this group of schools, for sophomores Cadence Patrick and Sakai Parker, it came down to something very basic.
I'm able to, you know, look around and feel like the people around me understand me. It's possible that I can be in a space that is designed specifically for me as a black woman, but I can also feel like a sense of belonging and never have to question that.
And that's a powerful reason, they say, that students will increasingly pick HBCUs. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Hari Srinivasan in Atlanta.
Nina Totenberg has been covering the Supreme Court for NPR since the 1970s, and it was early in her reporting career that she formed what would become a decades-long friendship with the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I spoke with Nina yesterday about their relationship, which is also the focus of her new book, Dinners with Ruth, a memoir on the power of friendships. Nina Totenberg, thank you very much for joining us. One thing that people may not know is that you met Ruth Bader Ginsburg in 1971, 20 years before she was on the Supreme Court. Tell us that story.
Well, I called her up because I didn't understand something in a brief she'd filed in what turned out to be the first major sex discrimination case in which the Supreme Court said women are covered by the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment.
She was a law professor.
And she was a law professor at Rutgers, and I called her up and I got an hour-long lecture. And after that, I started calling her more and more, and we became first professional friends and then personal friends.
And what kind of friendship was it? I mean, you have so many stories in the book about times you spent together. How close were you truly to her?
Well, I think I was most close to her toward the end of her life in the last couple of years, especially during the lockdown when our house was really the only place outside her apartment that she went. My husband cooked dinner for her and me about, I think, 23 or 24 straight Saturdays. And they were always reserved for Ruth. But we were always close, but I didn't see her every day or every week. Sometimes I saw her from a distance on the bench. But we were lifelong friends, essentially, from the time we were young women on.
There is an overused adage about this town, which goes along this line. If you want a real friend in Washington, get a dog. It's a reference to how transactional so many relationships are. But you haven't found that.
No, and my experience has been quite to the contrary, that if you're interested in people and you like people, they're interested in you, and like you back. And I had conservative friends like Justice Scalia, who were my friends for decades, in addition to Ruth, and other people that who are not household words. And it was really important to me, and I think to them, that we were able to be friends, despite whatever they didn't like, maybe something I wrote about them or whatever. They could get over it, and I could get over it.
From another angle, Nina Totenberg, there's this criticism that reporters, that the press, is sometimes too close to their sources and that it's not a healthy thing. How do you see that?
Well, it's not easy sometimes to write critically about somebody you like, but it's your job. And my experience has been that it's better to know the people you're covering and understand who they are than to not know these people at all. But there are boundaries, and when you cover a Supreme Court justice or a judge, the boundaries are pretty clear.
And what are they?
You treat them, you write about what they do and what they, the product they produce, their opinions. And they don't discuss what goes on behind the scenes or what's happening in a pending case. They're not supposed to, and they don't.
But doesn't being friends with someone make you more disposed to want to see their side of a story, of an argument?
Well, you want to see everybody's side. That's sort of what we're supposed to do. When I write a story, my object is to make sure it's fair and that everybody has their say-so. And what I think is, frankly, not relevant.
I want to circle back to Justice Ginsburg. She was well known for her friendship with the late Justice Antonin Scalia, who couldn't have been more different from her, apparently, in terms of their judicial philosophy. Is that kind of friendship possible in today's court, do you think?
I'm not sure. I mean, the court now today seems quite riven by divisions, and there is no center of the court. In the decades that I've covered the court, there always was a center, one, two, or three people who were not in one camp or another, and it sort of made everybody try to reach consensus, I think, a little more. That's not true today. There are six very conservative justices. It's probably a court more conservative than any court in maybe 90 years. And it seems to me that after the leak, the celebrated leak, mm-hmm. especially that it's a court with a lot of problems.
And what do you think that portends in terms of what this court is going to be able to do?
I don't know. I mean, the Chief Justice has talked about that people should still trust the court even when they don't agree. But when the court itself is so internally divided and so unhappy with each other, I think, it doesn't help matters.
The last thing I want to ask you about, also related to Justice Ginsburg, is the Dobbs decision. You make it very clear in the book how she had this long-standing view of women's reproductive rights, mm-hmm. even though she thought that the Roe decision might have been too sweeping, too much, too fast. But she still had very strong views on it. Do you think if she were still on the court that we would have seen the Dobbs decision?
This is one of the things. It's an indeterminate. But I don't think that there were the votes. The difference is that if she had been there still, it would have been 5-4, and just Chief Justice Roberts, who had a more modest approach to limiting Roe, I guess one would say, might well have prevailed. But it's 6-3, and they don't need his vote. I mean, he's a very active conservative Republican in some areas, but this was just a step too far for him, I think, and he made that pretty clear, and he couldn't get anybody to go along with him.
Well, the book is Nina Totenberg's Dinners with Ruth, a memoir on the power of friendships. Thank you, Nina.
Thank you, dear friend.
At the Emmys last night, Cheryl Lee Ralph won Best Supporting Actress for her role in the groundbreaking ABC series Abbott Elementary, which is taking on the issues confronting public education and equity with humor. Her acceptance speech itself won rave reviews as she sang an a cappella version of Endangered Species by Diane Reeves.
And the Emmy goes to Cheryl Lee Ralph.
Endangered species, but I sing no victim song. I am a woman, I am an artist, and I know.
How about that? Not your typical acceptance speech. So Jeff Bennett spoke with Cheryl Lee Ralph last spring for PBS Weekend as part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
It's a workplace comedy focused on a group of dedicated teachers at an underfunded elementary school in Philadelphia. The approach has provided new ways of looking at tough issues and refocusing the audience's attention on enduring problems. I'm joined by veteran actress Cheryl Lee Ralph, who plays Barbara Howard, an elementary school teacher who has seen it all on the show. She's also known for her breakthrough roles as Dina Jones in Broadway's Dreamgirls, which earned her a Tony nomination for Best Actress in a Musical. She later became a cultural fixture thanks to roles in TV shows like Moesha and films such as Sister Act 2. Welcome, Cheryl Lee Ralph. It's great to have you here on the NewsHour.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We should say that this show is ABC's first comedy to quadruple its ratings since its premiere. Why do you think the show is resonating in the way that it is?
There's something about the way this show, with the use of entertainment, comedy, is talking about something that's on everybody's minds, and that is teachers and the education, or lack thereof, of America's children.
Bull. Right. Sometimes spelled B-U-L, which is interesting.
What is going on in this classroom?
Hey, Mrs. Howard. I'm just teaching the kids some sight words.
You're abandoning the phonics principle that these children need. This is a classroom, not a hoagie stand.
Oh, boom. Hoagie.
Hoagie. Abbott Elementary is all about paying attention to the needs of some of the most underrated, underappreciated people in America. Okay, America's teachers.
Young bulls are so disrespectful.
They deserve more. They deserve more respect. They deserve more support. They deserve to be paid more. More should be given to those who mold the hearts and the minds of America's children. Do not take what it is they bring to this country, to their communities, to our cities. Do not underestimate that, because when you underestimate that, you underestimate the possibility of America's children.
It strikes me that comedy is an interesting way to look at these issues and elevate them, and people don't really even know that they're learning something as they're watching the show.
Absolutely. That is the magic of Quinta Brunson, our young creator. You know, her mother was a teacher, so she went to school with her mother for years. She saw the inward workings of schools, like Philadelphia, where she's from.
I was in the gifted program, too.
Who were you gifted at? Being annoying?
No.
People laugh. They laugh. They enjoy it. And then they have conversations that last for hours once the show is over. I mean, comedy is an amazing thing. It deserves more respect, just like teachers.
How's it going with the new program?
Oh, it's a little hard to understand, but I'm getting the hang of it.
Somehow lost my crypto wallet. But you come from a different generation, and so it'll be totally understandable if you were having trouble with it.
Are you kidding me? I'm Miss Tech, you know. I love tech. Shop at the App Store, got a Hotmail. I once even rode in a Tesla.
And I was like, oh my God, I love this girl. I love her. She and I had actually met on the set of another show called A Black Lady Sketch Show. And she spent a great deal of time just looking at me, just observing me. And it was wonderful some 18 months later to get this call of an offer for this show that she had. And she just wanted me to, would you please just meet all the people, Miss Ralph?
What do you think, given your vantage point in your career, you have opened so many doors for young actresses and producers, and you have folks like Quinta Brunson, Issa Rae, and Lena Waithe, who are not only stars of their own projects, but creators and producers of them.
You know what? It has been a long and rocky road to get to this place in an industry that when I was younger than they are now, was very quick to tell me that there was no place in it for me, that it could only be a side hobby because there was so little that would be made available to me. How would I possibly make a living out of it? But I had such incredible mentors that came before me.
They just don't make men like Sidney Poitier anymore.
They most certainly do not.
Sidney Poitier, who we recently lost, cast me in my very first film, taught me so much about what it was like to be in an industry that was going to make it difficult for you. I love what I do so much. I know the heavy lifting that went on and took place to get us to this beautiful time.
Wow. This past December marks 40 years since the legendary Broadway production of Dreamgirls, for which you were nominated for a Tony, as we mentioned. Yeah. When you reflect back, how do you sort of characterize the impact of that role on your career and the culture generally?
There's something about the lyrics in the song. Every girl has her own special dream. And those dreams are about to come true if you just open your eyes to what's in front of you. From then until now, I say to all those little girls, look in the mirror, open your eyes, and love what you see because you are your dream come true.
Shirley Ralph, thanks so much for your time. And again, congratulations on the success of Abbott Elementary.
Thank you. I am Barbara Howard.
Later this evening on PBS, Twin Cities PBS presents a documentary about those who struggle with thoughts of suicide and those who decide to take their own lives. Facing Suicide explores the stories of Americans impacted by suicide and journeys to the front lines of medical and scientific research to meet those who are working to help people at risk.
Lonely, really lonely. When you're depressed, man, the only thing you can think about is yourself. I did have a lot of people there for me, but I was just pushing them away, you know, not even giving them a chance.
The community has a role to play in preventing suicide. You can come around that individual to remind them they're worthy. There is help, there's a way through any challenge.
If you're thinking about killing yourself, just know that you're loved, know that you're cared for. Today might be hard, but tomorrow's a new day.
Facing Suicide premieres tonight on PBS stations. You may check your local listings. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.